It is strange that they've done nothing to stop us so far. You say they weren't entirely in the dark? This book is continued on cassette number 3, side 1. Lee nodded slowly. Yet it is strange that they've done nothing to stop us so far. You say they weren't entirely in the dark? Farah stumbles at the edges of the problem. Sometimes he makes me nervous, and Peren's been suspicious of me since I was elected. But you see, they've never had the capacity of really understanding what was up. Their whole training has been authoritarian. They are sure that the Emperor, just because he is the Emperor, is all-powerful. And they are sure that the Board of Trustees, simply because it is the Board of Trustees acting in the name of the Emperor, cannot be in a position where it does not give the orders. That incapacity to recognize the possibility of revolt is our best ally. He heaved out of his chair and went to the water cooler. They're not bad fellows, Lee, when they stick to their encyclopedia, and we'll see that that's where they stick in the future. They're hopelessly incompetent when it comes to ruling Terminus. Go away now and start things rolling. I want to be alone. He sat down on the corner of his desk and stared at the cup of water. Space. If only he were as confident as he pretended. The Anacreonians were landing in 2 days, and what had he to go on but a set of notions and half-guesses as to what Harry Seldon had been driving at these past 50 years? He wasn't even a real, honest-to-goodness psychologist, just a fumbler with a little training trying to outguess the greatest mind of the age. If Farrow were right, if Anacreon were all the problem Harry Seldon had foreseen, if the encyclopedia were all he was interested in preserving, then what price coup d'etat? He shrugged and drank his water. 7. The vault was furnished with considerably more than 6 chairs, as though a larger company had been expected. Harden noted that thoughtfully and seated himself wearily in a corner just as far from the other 5 as possible. The board members did not seem to object to that arrangement. They spoke among themselves in whispers, which fell off into sibilant monosyllables and then into nothing at all. Of them all, only Jord Farah seemed even reasonably calm. He had produced a watch and was staring at it somberly. Harden glanced at his own watch and then at the glass cubicle. Absolutely empty, dominated half the room. It was the only unusual feature of the room, for aside from that there was no indication that somewhere a speck of radium was wasting away toward that precise moment when a tumbler would fall, a connection be made, and the lights went dim. They didn't go out, but merely yellowed and sank with a suddenness that made Harden jump. He lifted his eyes to the ceiling lights in startled fashion, and when he brought them down, the glass cubicle was no longer empty. A figure occupied it, a figure in a wheelchair. It said nothing for a few moments, but it closed the book upon its lap and fingered it idly, and then it smiled, and the face seemed all alive. It said, "I am Harry Seldon." The voice was old and soft. Harden almost rose to acknowledge the introduction and stopped himself in the act. The voice continued conversationally. "As you see, I am confined to this chair and cannot rise to greet you. Your grandparents left for Terminus a few months back in my time, and since then I have suffered a rather inconvenient paralysis. I can't see you, you know, so I can't greet you properly. I don't even know how many of you there are, so all this must be conducted informally. If any of you are standing, please sit down, and if you care to smoke, I wouldn't mind." There was a light chuckle. "Why should I? I'm not really here." Harden fumbled for a cigar almost automatically, but thought better of it. Harry Seldon put away his book, as if laying it upon a desk at his side, and when his fingers let go, it disappeared. He said, "It is 50 years now since this foundation was established, 50 years in which the members of the foundation have been ignorant of what it was they were working toward. It was necessary that they be ignorant, but now the necessity is gone. The Encyclopedia Foundation, to begin with, is a fraud, and always has been." There was the sound of a scramble behind Harden, and one or two muffled exclamations, but he did not turn around. Harry Seldon was, of course, undisturbed. He went on, "It is a fraud in the sense that neither I nor my colleagues care at all whether a single volume of the encyclopedia is ever published. It has served its purpose, since by it we extracted an imperial charter from the Emperor, by it we attracted the 100,000 humans necessary for our scheme, and by it we managed to keep them preoccupied while events shaped themselves until it was too late for any of them to draw back. In the 50 years that you have worked on this fraudulent project, there is no use in softening phrases. Your retreat has been cut off, and you have now no choice but to proceed on the infinitely more important project that was and is our real plan. To that end, we have placed you on such a planet and at such a time that in 50 years you are maneuvered to the point where you no longer have freedom of action. From now on, and into the centuries, the path you must take is inevitable. You will be faced with a series of crises, as you are now faced with the first. And in each case, your freedom of action will become similarly circumscribed so that you will be forced along one and only one path. It is that path which our psychology has worked out, and for a reason. For centuries, galactic civilization has stagnated and declined, though only a few ever realized that. But now, at last, the periphery is breaking away, and the political unity of the empire is shattered. Somewhere in the 50 years just past is where the historians of the future will place an arbitrary line and say, "This marks the fall of the galactic empire." And they will be right, though scarcely any will recognize that fall for additional centuries. And after the fall will come inevitable barbarism, a period which our psychohistory tells us should, under ordinary circumstances, last for 30,000 years. We cannot stop the fall. We do not wish to, for empire culture has lost whatever virility and worth it once had. But we can shorten the period of barbarism that must follow down to a single thousand of years. The ins and outs of that shortening we cannot tell you, just as we could not tell you the truth about the Foundation 50 years ago. Were you to discover those ins and outs, our plan might fail, as it would have had you penetrated the fraud of the encyclopedia earlier. For then, by knowledge, your freedom of action would be expanded, and the number of additional variables introduced would become greater than our psychology could handle. But you won't, for there are no psychologists on Terminus, and never were but for Aluren, and he was one of us. But this I can tell you. Terminus and its companion foundation at the other end of the galaxy are the seeds of the Renaissance and the future founders of the Second Galactic Empire. And it is the present crisis that is starting Terminus off to that climax. This, by the way, is a rather straightforward crisis, much simpler than many of those that are ahead. To reduce it to its fundamentals, it is this. You are a planet suddenly cut off from the still civilized centers of the galaxy and threatened by your stronger neighbors. You are a small world of scientists, surrounded by vast and rapidly expanding reaches of barbarism. You are an island of atomic power in a growing ocean of more primitive energy, but are helpless despite that because of your lack of metals. You see, then, that you are faced by hard necessity and that action is forced on you. The nature of that action, that is, the solution to your dilemma, is, of course, obvious. The image of Harry Seldon reached into open air, and the book once more appeared in his hand. He opened it and said, "But whatever devious course your future history may take, impress it always upon your descendants that the path has been marked out, and that at its end is new and greater empire." And as his eyes bent to his book, he flicked into nothingness, and the lights brightened once more. Hardin looked up to see Perrin facing him, eyes tragic and lips trembling. The chairman's voice was firm but toneless. "You were right, it seems. If you will see us tonight at 6, the board will consult with you as to the next move." They shook his hand, each one, and left, and Hardin smiled to himself. They were fundamentally sound at that, for they were scientists enough to admit that they were wrong, but for them it was too late. He looked at his watch. By this time it was all over. Lee's men were in control, and the board was giving orders no longer. The Anacreonians were landing their first spaceships tomorrow, but that was all right, too. In 6 months, they would be giving orders no longer. In fact, as Harry Seldon had said, and as Salvor Hardin had guessed since the day that Anselmo Roderick had first revealed to him Anacreon's lack of atomic power, the solution to this first crisis was obvious. Obvious as all hell. Part 3. The Mayors. 1. The Four Kingdoms, the name given to those portions of the province of Anacreon which broke away from the First Empire in the early years of the foundational era to form independent and short-lived kingdoms. The largest and most powerful of these was Anacreon itself, which in area... Undoubtedly, the most interesting aspect of the history of the Four Kingdoms involves the strange society forced temporarily upon it during the administration of Salvor Hardin. Encyclopedia Galactica. A deputation? That Salvor Hardin had seen it coming made it none the more pleasant. On the contrary, he found anticipation distinctly annoying. Johann Lee advocated extreme measures. "I don't see, Hardin," he said, "that we need waste any time. They can't do anything till next election, legally anyway, and that gives us a year. Give them the brush off." Hardin pursed his lips. "Lee, you'll never learn. In the 40 years I've known you, you've never once learned the gentle art of sneaking up from behind." "It's not my way of fighting," grumbled Lee. "Yes, I know that. I suppose that's why you're the one man I trust." He paused and reached for a cigar. "We've come a long way, Lee, since we engineered our coup against the encyclopedist way back. I'm getting old. 62. Do you ever think how fast those 30 years went?" Lee snorted. "I don't feel old, and I'm 66. "Yes, but I haven't your digestion." Hardin sucked lazily at his cigar. He had long since stopped wishing for the mild vegan tobacco of his youth. Those days when the planet Terminus had trafficked with every part of the Galactic Empire belonged in the limbo to which all good old days go, toward the same limbo where the Galactic Empire was heading. He wondered who the new emperor was, or if there was a new emperor at all, or any empire. Space. For 30 years now, since the breakup of communications here at the edge of the galaxy, the whole universe of Terminus had consisted of itself and the four surrounding kingdoms. How the mighty had fallen. Kingdoms. They were prefects in the old days, all part of the same province, which in turn had been part of a sector, which in turn had been part of a quadrant, which in turn had been part of the all-embracing galactic empire. And now that the empire had lost control over the farther reaches of the galaxy, these little splinter groups of planets became kingdoms, with comic opera kings and nobles and petty, meaningless wars, and a life that went on pathetically among the ruins. A civilization falling, atomic power forgotten, science fading to mythology, until the Foundation had stepped in. The Foundation that Harry Seldon had established for just that purpose here on Terminus. Lee was at the window, and his voice broke in on Hardin's reverie. "They've come," he said. "In a last-model ground car, the young pups." He took a few uncertain steps toward the door and then looked at Hardin. Hardin smiled and waved him back. "I'd given orders to have them brought up here." "Here? What for? You're making them too important." "Why go through all the ceremonies of an official mayor's audience? I'm getting too old for red tape. Besides which, flattery is useful when dealing with youngsters, particularly when it doesn't commit you to anything." He winked. "Sit down, Lee. Give me your moral backing. I'll need it with this young Cermak." "That fellow Cermak," said Lee heavily, "is dangerous. He's got a following, Hardin, so don't underestimate him." "Have I ever underestimated anybody?" "Well, then, arrest him. You can accuse him of something or other afterward." Hardin ignored that last bit of advice. "There they are, Lee." In response to the signal, he stepped on the pedal beneath his desk, and the door slid aside. They filed in, the four that composed the deputation, and Hardin waved them gently to the armchairs that faced his desk in a semicircle. They bowed and waited for the mayor to speak first. Hardin flicked open the curiously carved silver lid of the cigar box that had once belonged to Jord Farah of the old Board of Trustees in the long-dead days of the encyclopedists. It was a genuine Empire product from Santani, though the cigars it now contained were homegrown. One by one, with grave solemnity, the four of the deputation accepted cigars and lit up in ritualistic fashion. Sep Cermak was second from the right, the youngest of the young group, and the most interesting, with his bristly yellow mustache trimmed precisely and his sunken eyes of uncertain color. The other three Hardin dismissed almost immediately. They were rank and file on the face of them. It was on Cermak that he concentrated, the Cermak who had already, in his first term on the city council, turned that sedate body topsy-turvy more than once, and it was to Cermak that he said, "I've been particularly anxious to see you, Councilman, ever since your very excellent speech last month. Your attack on the foreign policy of this government was a most capable one." Cermak's eyes smoldered. "Your interest honors me. The attack may or may not have been capable, but it was certainly justified." "Perhaps. Your opinions are yours, of course. Still, you are rather young." Dryly. "It is a fault that most people are guilty of at some period of their life. You became mayor of the city when you were 2 years younger than I am now." Hardin smiled to himself. The yearling was a cool customer. He said, I take it now that you have come to see me concerning this same foreign policy that annoys you so greatly in the council chamber. Are you speaking for your three colleagues, or must I listen to each of you separately? There were quick mutual glances among the four young men, a slight flickering of eyelids. Sir Max said grimly, I speak for the people of Terminus, the people who are not now truly represented in the rubber-stamp body they call the council. I see. Go ahead, then. It comes to this, Mr. Mayor. We are dissatisfied. By we, you mean the people, don't you? Sir Max stared hostily, sensing a trap, and replied coldly, I believe that my views reflect those of the majority of the voters of Terminus. Does that suit you? Well, a statement like that is all the better for proof. But go on anyway. You are dissatisfied. Yes, dissatisfied with the policy which for 30 years has been stripping Terminus defenseless against the inevitable attack from outside. I see. And therefore, go on, go on. It's nice of you to anticipate. And therefore, we are forming a new political party, one that will stand for the immediate needs of Terminus, and not for a mystic, manifest destiny of future empire. We are going to throw you and your lickspittle clique of appeasers out of City Hall, and that soon. Unless, there's always an unless, you know. Not much of one in this case, unless you resign now. I'm not asking you to change your policies. I wouldn't trust you that far. Your promises are worth nothing. An outright resignation is all we'll take. I see. Hardin crossed his legs and teetered his chair back on two legs. That's your ultimatum. Nice of you to give me warning, but you see, I rather think I'll ignore it. Don't think it was a warning, Mr. Mayor. It was an announcement of principles and of action. The new party has already been formed, and it will begin its official activities tomorrow. There is neither room nor desire for compromise, and frankly, it was only our recognition of your services to the city that induced us to offer the easy way out. I didn't think you'd take it, but my conscience is clear. The next election will be a more forcible and quite irresistible reminder that resignation is necessary. He rose and motioned the rest up. Hardin lifted his arm. Hold on. Sit down. Seth Cermak seated himself once more with just a shade too much alacrity, and Hardin smiled behind a straight face. In spite of his words, he was waiting for an offer. An offer. Hardin said, In exactly what way do you want our foreign policy changed? Do you want us to attack the four kingdoms now, at once, and all four simultaneously?
I make no such suggestion, Mr. Mayor. It is our simple proposition that all appeasement cease immediately. Throughout your administration, you have carried out a policy of scientific aid to the kingdoms. You have given them atomic power. You have helped rebuild power plants on their territories. You have established medical clinics, chemical laboratories, and factories.
Well, and your objection?
You have done this in order to keep them from attacking us. With these as bribes, you have been playing the fool in a colossal game of blackmail, in which you have allowed Terminus to be sucked dry, with the result that now we are at the mercy of these barbarians.
In what way?
Because you have given them power, given them weapons, actually serviced the ships of their navies. They are infinitely stronger than they were 3 decades ago. Their demands are increasing, and with their new weapons, they will eventually satisfy all their demands at once by violent annexation of Terminus. Isn't that the way blackmail usually ends?
And your remedy?
Stop the bribes immediately, and while you can. Spend your effort in strengthening Terminus itself, and attack first.
Hardin watched the young fellow's little blonde mustache with an almost morbid interest. Cermak felt sure of himself, or he wouldn't talk so much. There was no doubt that his remarks were the reflection of a pretty huge segment of the population. Pretty huge. His voice did not betray the slightly perturbed current of his thoughts. It was almost negligent. Are you finished?
For the moment.
Well then, do you notice the framed statement I have on the wall behind me? Read it, if you will. Cermak's lips twitched.
It says, violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. That's an old man's doctrine, Mr. Mayor.
I applied it as a young man, Mr. Councilman, and successfully. You were busily being born when it happened, but perhaps you may have read something of it in school. He eyed Cermak closely and continued in measured tones. When Harry Seldon established the foundation here, it was for the ostensible purpose of producing a great encyclopedia, and for 50 years we followed that will-o'-the-wisp before discovering what he was really after. By that time it was almost too late. When communications with the central regions of the old empire broke down, we found ourselves a world of scientists concentrated in a single city, possessing no industries and surrounded by newly created kingdoms, hostile and largely barbarous. We were a tiny island of atomic power in this ocean of barbarism, and an infinitely valuable prize. Anacreon, then as now the most powerful of the four kingdoms, demanded and actually established a military base upon Terminus. And the then rulers of the city, the encyclopedists, knew very well that this was only a preliminary to taking over the entire planet. That is how matters stood when I assumed actual government. What would you have done? Cermak shrugged his shoulders. That's an academic question. Of course I know what you did. I'll repeat it anyway. Perhaps you don't get the point. The temptation was great to muster what force we could and put up a fight. It's the easiest way out and the most satisfactory to self-respect, but nearly invariably the stupidest. You would have done it, you and your talk of attack first. What I did instead was to visit the three other kingdoms one by one, point out to each that to allow the secret of atomic power to fall into the hands of Anacreon was the quickest way of cutting their own throats, and suggest gently that they do the obvious thing. That was all. 1 month after the Anacreonian force had landed on Terminus, their king received a joint ultimatum from his three neighbors. In 7 days, the last Anacreonian was off Terminus. Now tell me, where was the need for violence? The young councilman regarded his cigar stub thoughtfully and tossed it into the incinerator chute. I fail to see the analogy. Insulin will bring a diabetic to normal without the faintest need of a knife, but appendicitis needs an operation. You can't help that. When other courses have failed, what is left but, as you put it, the last refuge? It's your fault that we're driven to it.
I?
Oh, yes. Again, my policy of appeasement. You still seem to lack grasp of the fundamental necessities of our position. Our problem wasn't over with the departure of the Anacreonians. They had just begun. The four kingdoms were more our enemies than ever, for each wanted atomic power, and each was kept off our throats only for fear of the other three. We are balanced on the point of a very sharp sword, and the slightest sway in any direction, if, for instance, one kingdom becomes too strong, or if two form a coalition, you understand?
Certainly. That was the time to begin all-out preparations for war.
On the contrary, that was the time to begin all-out prevention of war. I played them one against the other. I helped each in turn. I offered them science, trade, education, scientific medicine. I made Terminus of more value to them as a flourishing world than as a military prize. It worked for 30 years.
Yes, but you were forced to surround these scientific gifts with the most outrageous mummery. You've made half-religion, half-balderdash out of it. You've erected a hierarchy of priests and complicated, meaningless ritual.
Hardin frowned. What of that? I don't see that it has anything to do with the argument at all. I started that way at first, because the barbarians looked upon our science as a sort of magical sorcery, and it was easiest to get them to accept it on that basis. The priesthood built itself, and if we help it along, we are only following the line of least resistance. It is a minor matter.
But these priests are in charge of the power plants. That is not a minor matter.
True, but we have trained them. Their knowledge of their tools is purely empirical, and they have a firm belief in the mummery that surrounds them.
And if one pierces through the mummery and has the genius to brush aside empiricism, what is to prevent him from learning actual techniques and selling out to the most satisfactory bidder? What price our value to the kingdoms then?
Little chance of that, Cermak. You are being superficial. The best men on the planets of the kingdoms are sent here to the Foundation each year and educated into the priesthood, and the best of these remain here as research students. If you think that those who are left, with practically no knowledge of the elementals of science, or worse still, with the distorted knowledge the priests receive, can penetrate at a bound to atomic power, to electronics, to the theory of the hyperwarp, you have a very romantic and very foolish idea of science. It takes lifetimes of training and an excellent brain to get that far. Johann Lee had risen abruptly during the foregoing speech and left the room. He had returned now, and when Hardin finished speaking, he bent to his superior's ear. A whisper was exchanged, and then a leaden cylinder. Then, with one short, hostile look at the deputation, Lee resumed his chair. Hardin turned the cylinder end for end in his hands, watching the deputation through his lashes. Then he opened it with a hard, sudden twist, and only Cermak had the sense not to throw a rapid look at the rolled paper that fell out. "In short, gentlemen," he said, "the government is of the opinion that it knows what it is doing." He read as he spoke. There were the lines of intricate, meaningless code that covered the page, and the three penciled words scrawled in one corner that carried the message. He took it in at a glance and tossed it casually into the incinerator shaft. "That," Hardin then said, "ends the interview, I'm afraid. Glad to have met you all. Thank you for coming." He shook hands with each in perfunctory fashion, and they filed out. Hardin had almost gotten out of the habit of laughing, But after Cermak and his three silent partners were well out of earshot, he indulged in a dry chuckle and bent an amused look on Lee. "How did you like that battle of bluffs, Lee?" Lee snorted grumpily. "I'm not sure that he was bluffing. Treat him with kid gloves, and he's quite liable to win the next election, just as he says." "Oh, quite likely. Quite likely, if nothing happens first." "Make sure they don't happen in the wrong direction this time, Hardin. I tell you this, Cermak has a following. What if he doesn't wait till the next election? There was a time when you and I put things through violently in spite of your slogan about what violence is." Hardin cocked an eyebrow. "You are pessimistic today, Lee, and singularly contrary, too, or you wouldn't speak of violence. Our own little putsch was carried through without loss of life, you remember. It was a necessary measure put through at the proper moment, and went over smoothly, painlessly, and all but effortlessly. As for Cermak, he's up against a different proposition. You and I, Lee, aren't the encyclopedists. We stand prepared. Sick your men under these youngsters in a nice way, old fellow. Don't let them know they're being watched, but eyes open, you understand?" Lee laughed in sour amusement. "I'd be a fine one to wait for your orders, wouldn't I, Hardin? Cermak and his men have been under surveillance for a month now." The mayor chuckled. "Got in first, did you? All right. By the way," he observed and added softly, "Ambassador Verisov is returning to Terminus temporarily." There was a short silence, faintly horrified, and then Lee said, "Was that the message? Are things breaking already?" "Dunno. I can't tell until I hear what Verisov has to say. They may be, though. After all, they have to before election. But what are you looking so dead about?" "Because I don't know how it's going to turn out. You're too deep, Hardin, and you're playing the game too close to your chest." "Thou too, Rutus," murmured Hardin. And aloud, "Does that mean you're going to join Cermak's new party?" Lee smiled against his will. "All right, you win. How about lunch now?" 2. There are many epigrams attributed to Hardin, a confirmed epigrammist, a good many of which are probably apocryphal. Nevertheless, it is reported that on a certain occasion he said, "It pays to be obvious, especially if you have a reputation for subtlety." Poli Verisov had had occasion to act on that advice more than once, for he was now in the 14th year of his double status on Anacreon, a double status the upkeep of which reminded him often and unpleasantly of a dance performed barefoot on hot metal. To the people of Anacreon, he was high priest, representative of that foundation which, to those barbarians, was the acme of mystery and the physical center of this religion they had created with Hardin's help in the last 3 decades. As such, he received a homage that had become horribly wearying, for from his soul he despised the ritual of which he was the center. But to the king of Anacreon, the old one that had been, and the young grandson that was now on the throne, he was simply the ambassador of a power at once feared and coveted. On the whole, it was an uncomfortable job, and his first trip to the Foundation in 3 years, despite the disturbing incident that had made it necessary, was something in the nature of a holiday. And, since it was not the first time he had had to travel in absolute secrecy, he again made use of Hardin's epigram on the uses of the obvious. He changed into his civilian clothes, a holiday in itself, and boarded a passenger liner to the Foundation, second class. Once at Terminus, he threaded his way through the crowd at the spaceport and called up City Hall at a public visiphone. He said, "My name is Jan Smite. I have an appointment with the mayor this afternoon." The dead-voiced but efficient young lady at the other end made a second connection and exchanged a few rapid words, then said to Verisov in dry, mechanical tone, "Mayor Hardin will see you in half an hour, sir." And the screen went blank. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Whereupon the ambassador to Anacreon bought the latest edition of the Terminus City Journal, sauntered casually to City Hall Park, and sitting down on the first empty bench he came to, read the editorial page, sports section, and comic sheet while waiting. At the end of half an hour, he tucked the paper under his arm, entered City Hall, and presented himself in the anteroom. In doing all this, he remained safely and thoroughly unrecognized, for since he was so entirely obvious, no one gave him a second look. Hardin looked up at him and grinned. "Have a cigar. How was the trip?" Verisov helped himself. "Interesting. There was a priest in the next cabin on his way here to take a special course in the preparation of radioactive synthetics for the treatment of cancer, you know." "Surely he didn't call it radioactive synthetics now?" "I guess not. It was the holy food to him." The mayor smiled. "Go on." "He inveigled me into a theological discussion and did his level best to elevate me out of sordid materialism." "And never recognized his own high priest?" without my crimson robe. Besides, he was a Smyrnian. It was an interesting experience, though. It is remarkable, Hardin, how the religion of science has grabbed hold. I've written an essay on the subject, entirely for my own amusement. It wouldn't do to have it published. Treating the problem sociologically, it would seem that when the old empire began to rot at the fringes, it could be considered that science, as science, had failed the outer worlds. To be reaccepted, it would have to present itself in another guise, and it has done just that. It works out beautifully when you use symbolic logic to help out. Interesting. The mayor placed his arms behind his neck and said suddenly, "Start talking about the situation at Anacreon." The ambassador frowned and withdrew the cigar from his mouth. He looked at it distastefully and put it down. "Well, it's pretty bad. You wouldn't be here otherwise." "Scarcely. Here's the position. The key man at Anacreon is the Prince Regent, Venus. He's King Leopold's uncle." "I know, but Leopold is coming of age next year, isn't he? I believe he'll be 16 in February." "Yes." Pause, and then a wry addition. "If he lives. The king's father died under suspicious circumstances, a needle bullet through the chest during a hunt. It was called an accident." "Humph. I seem to remember, Venus, the time I was on Anacreon when we kicked them off Terminus. It was before your time. Let's see now. If I remember, he was a dark young fellow, black hair and a squint in his right eye. He had a funny hook in his nose." "Same fella. The hook and the squint are still there, but his hair's gray now. He plays the game dirty. Luckily, he's the most egregious fool on the planet. Fancies himself as a shrewd devil, too, which makes his folly the more transparent." "That's usually the way. His notion of cracking an egg is to shoot an atomic blast at it. Witness the tax on temple property he tried to impose just after the old king died 2 years ago. Remember?" Hardin nodded thoughtfully, then smiled. "The priests raised a howl. They raised one you could hear way out to Lucrezia. He's shown more caution in dealing with the priesthood since, but he still manages to do things the hard way. In a way, it's unfortunate for us. He has unlimited self-confidence. Probably an overcompensated inferiority complex. Younger sons of royalty get that way, you know." "But it amounts to the same thing. He's foaming at the mouth with eagerness to attack the Foundation. He scarcely troubles to conceal it. And he's in a position to do it, too, from the standpoint of armament. The old king built up a magnificent navy, and Venus hasn't been sleeping the last 2 years. In fact, the tax on temple property was originally intended for further armament, and when that fell through, he increased the income tax twice." "Any grumbling at that?" "None of serious importance. Obedience to appointed authority was the text of every sermon in the kingdom for weeks. Not that Venus showed any gratitude." "All right, I've got the background. Now what's happened?" 2 weeks ago, an Anacreonian merchant ship came across a derelict battle cruiser of the old Imperial Navy. It must have been drifting in space for at least 3 centuries. Interest flickered in Hardin's eyes. He sat up. "Yes, I've heard of that. The Board of Navigation has sent me a petition asking me to obtain the ship for purposes of study. It is in good condition, I understand."
"In entirely too good condition," responded Verisov dryly. "When Venus received your suggestion last week that he turn the ship over to the Foundation, he almost had convulsions."
"He hasn't answered yet."
"He won't, except with guns, or so he thinks. You see, he came to me on the day I left Anacreon and requested that the Foundation put this battle cruiser into fighting order and turn it over to the Anacreonian Navy. He had the infernal gall to say that your note of last week indicated a plan of the Foundation's to attack Anacreon. He said that refusal to repair the battlecruiser would confirm his suspicions, and indicated that measures for the self-defense of Anacreon would be forced upon him." "Those are his words. Forced upon him. And that's why I'm here."
Hardin laughed gently. Verisov smiled and continued, "Of course, he expects a refusal, and it would be a perfect excuse, in his eyes, for immediate attack."
"I see that, Verisov. Well, we have at least 6 months to spare, so have the ship fixed up and present it with my compliments. Have it renamed the Venus as a mark of our esteem and affection."
He laughed again. And again Verisov responded with the faintest trace of a smile.
"I suppose it's the logical step, Hardin, but I'm worried."
"What about?"
"It's a ship. They could build in those days. Its cubic capacity is half again that of the entire Anacreonian Navy. It's got atomic blasts capable of blowing up a planet, and a shield that could take a Q-beam without working up radiation. Too much of a good thing, Hardin."
"Superficial, Verisov, superficial.
You and I both know that the armament he now has could defeat Terminus handily, long before we could repair the cruiser for our own use. What does it matter, then, if we give him the cruiser as well? You know it won't ever come to actual war.
I suppose so, yes. The ambassador looked up. But Hardin...
Well, why do you stop? Go ahead.
Look, this isn't my province, but I've been reading the paper. He placed the journal on the desk and indicated the front page. What's this all about?
Hardin dropped a casual glance.
A group of councilmen are forming a new political party.
That's what it says. Verasov fidgeted. I know you're in better touch with internal matters than I am, but they're attacking you with everything short of physical violence. How strong are they?
Damn strong. They'll probably control the council after next election.
Not before.
Verasov looked at the mayor obliquely. There are ways of gaining control besides elections.
Do you take me for weenus?
No. But repairing the ship will take months, and an attack after that is certain. Our yielding will be taken as a sign of appalling weakness, and the addition of the Imperial cruiser will just about double the strength of Weena's navy. He'll attack as sure as I'm a high priest. Why take chances? Do one of two things. Either reveal the plan of campaign to the Council, or force the issue with Anacreon now.
Hardin frowned. Force the issue now, before the crisis comes? It's the one thing I mustn't do. There's Harry Seldon in the plan, you know.
Verasov hesitated, then muttered, You're absolutely sure, then, that there is a plan.
There can scarcely be any doubt, came the stiff reply. I was present at the opening of the time vault, and Seldon's recording revealed it then.
I didn't mean that, Hardin. I just don't see how it could be possible to chart history for 1,000 years ahead. Maybe Seldon overestimated himself.
He shriveled a bit at Hardin's ironical smile and added,
Well, I'm no psychologist.
Exactly. None of us are. But I did receive some elementary training in my youth, enough to know what psychology is capable of, even if I can't exploit its capabilities myself. There's no doubt but that Seldon did exactly what he claims to have done. The Foundation, as he says, was established as a scientific refuge, the means by which the science and culture of the dying empire was to be preserved through the centuries of barbarism that have begun, to be rekindled in the end into a second empire.
Verasov nodded, a trifle doubtfully. Everyone knows that's the way things are supposed to go. But can we afford to take chances? Can we risk the present for the sake of a nebulous future?
We must, because the future isn't nebulous. It's been calculated out by Seldon and charted. Each successive crisis in our history is mapped, and each depends in a measure on the successful conclusion of the ones previous. This is only the second crisis, and space knows what effect even a trifling deviation would have in the end.
That's a rather empty speculation.
No. Harry Seldon said in the Time Vault that at each crisis our freedom of action would become circumscribed to the point where only one course of action was possible.
So as to keep us on the straight and narrow?
So as to keep us from deviating, yes. But conversely, as long as more than one course of action is possible, the crisis has not been reached. We must let things drift so long as we possibly can, and by space that's what I intend doing.
Verasov didn't answer. He chewed his lower lip in a grudging silence.
It had only been the year before that Hardin had first discussed the problem with him, the real problem, the problem of countering Anacreon's hostile preparations. And then only because he, Verasov, had balked at further appeasement.
Hardin seemed to follow his ambassador's thoughts. I would much rather never to have told you anything about this.
Well, what makes you say that? Said Verasov in surprise.
Because there are 6 people now. You and I, the other 3 ambassadors, and Johann Lee, who have a fair notion of what's ahead. And I'm damned afraid that it was Seldon's idea to have no one know.
Why so?
Because even Seldon's advanced psychology was limited. It could not handle too many independent variables. He couldn't work with individuals over any length of time, any more than you could apply the kinetic theory of gases to single molecules. He worked with mobs, populations of whole planets, and only blind mobs who do not possess foreknowledge of the results of their own actions.
That's not plain.
I can't help it. I'm not psychologist enough to explain it scientifically, but this you know. There are no trained psychologists on Terminus, and no mathematical texts on the science. It is plain that he wanted no one on Terminus capable of working out the future in advance. Seldon wanted us to proceed blindly, and therefore correctly, according to the law of mob psychology. As I once told you, I never knew where we were heading when I first drove out the Anacreonians. My idea had been to maintain balance of power, no more than that. It was only afterward that I thought I saw a pattern in events.
but I've done my level best not to act on that knowledge. Interference due to foresight would have knocked the plan out of kilter. Beresov nodded thoughtfully. I've heard arguments almost as complicated in the temples back on Anacreon. How do you expect to spot the right mode of action? It's spotted already. You admit that once we repair the battlecruiser, nothing will stop Venus from attacking us. There will no longer be any alternative in that respect. Yes? All right. That accounts for the external aspect. Meanwhile, you'll further admit that the next election will see a new and hostile council that will force action against Anacreon. There is no alternative there. Yes. And as soon as all the alternatives disappear, the crisis has come. Just the same, I get worried. He paused, and Beresov waited. Slowly, almost reluctantly, Hardin continued, I've got the idea, just a notion, that the external and internal pressures were planned to come to a head simultaneously. As it is, there's a few months' difference. Venus will probably attack before spring, and elections are still a year off. That doesn't sound important. I don't know. It may be due merely to unavoidable errors of calculation, or it might be due to the fact that I knew too much. I tried never to let my foresight influence my action, but how can I tell? And what effect will the discrepancy have? Anyway, he looked up, there's one thing I've decided. And what's that? When the crisis does begin to break, I'm going to Anacreon. I want to be on the spot. Oh, that's enough, Beresov. It's getting late. Let's go out and make a night of it. I want some relaxation. Then get it right here, said Beresov. I don't want to be recognized. Or you know what this new party your precious councilmen are forming would say. Call for the brandy. And Hardin did. But not for too much. 3. In the ancient days when the Galactic Empire had embraced the galaxy and Anacreon had been the richest of the prefects of the periphery, more than one emperor had visited the viceregal palace in state. And not one had left without at least one effort to pit his skill with air speedster and needle gun against the feathered flying fortress they call the Nyack Bird. The fame of Anacreon had withered to nothing with the decay of the times. The viceregal palace was a drafty mass of ruins, except for the wing that Foundation workmen had restored, and no emperor had been seen in Anacreon for 200 years. But Nyack hunting was still the royal sport, and a good eye with the needle gun still the first requirement of Anacreon's kings. Leopold I, king of Anacreon, and, as was invariably but untruthfully added, lord of the outer dominions, though not yet 16, had already proved his skill many times over. He had brought down his first Nyack when scarcely 13, had brought down his 10th the week after his accession to the throne, and was returning now from his 46th. 50 before I come of age, he had exulted. Who'll take the wager? But courtiers don't take wagers against the king's skill. There is the deadly danger of winning. So no one did, and the king left to change his clothes in high spirits. Leopold. The king stopped mid-step at the one voice that could cause him to do so. He turned sulkily. Venus stood upon the threshold of his chambers and beetled at his young nephew. Send them away, he motioned impatiently. Get rid of them. The king nodded curtly, and the two chamberlains bowed and backed down the stairs. Leopold entered his uncle's room. Venus stared at the king's hunting suit morosely. You'll have more important things to tend to than Nyack hunting soon enough. He turned his back and stumped to his desk. Since he had grown too old for the rush of air, the perilous dive within wingbeat of the Nyack, the roll and climb of the speedster at the motion of a foot, he had soured upon the whole sport. Leopold appreciated his uncle's sour grapes attitude, and it was not without malice that he began enthusiastically, But you should have been with us today, Uncle. We flushed one in the wilds of Samia that was a monster, and game as they come. We had it out for 2 hours over at least 70 square miles of ground, and when I got to sunwards, he was motioning graphically as though he were once more in his speedster, and dived torque-wise. Caught him on the rise, just under the left wing at quarters. It maddened him, and he cantered athwart. I took his dare and veered a left, waiting for the plummet. Sure enough, down he came. He was within wing-beat before I moved, and then...
Leopold.
Well, I got him.
I'm sure you did. Now will you attend?
The king shrugged and gravitated to the end table, where he nibbled at a lira nut in quite an unregal sulk. He did not dare to meet his uncle's eyes. Venus said, by way of preamble, I've been to the ship today.
What ship?
There is only one ship. The ship. The one the Foundation is repairing for the Navy. The old Imperial cruiser. Do I make myself sufficiently plain?
That one? You see, I told you the Foundation would repair it if we asked them to. It's all poppycock, you know, that story of yours about their wanting to attack us. Because if they did, why would they fix the ship? It doesn't make sense, you know.
Leopold, you're a fool. The king, who had just discarded the shell of the lira nut and was lifting another to his lips, flushed.
Well, now, look here,
he said with anger that scarcely rose above peevishness.
I don't think you ought to call me that. You forget yourself. I'll be of age in 2 months, you know.
Yes, and you're in a fine position to assume regal responsibilities. If you spent half the time on public affairs that you do on Nyack hunting, I'd resign the regency directly with a clear conscience.
I don't care. That has nothing to do with the case, you know. The fact is that even if you are the regent and my uncle, I'm still king and you're still my subject. You oughtn't to call me a fool, and you oughtn't to sit in my presence anyway. You haven't asked my permission. I think you ought to be careful, or I might do something about it pretty soon.
Weenus' gaze was cold. May I refer to you as Your Majesty?
Yes.
Very well. You are a fool, Your Majesty. His dark eyes blazed from beneath his grizzled brows, and the young king sat down slowly. For a moment, there was sardonic satisfaction in the regent's face, but it faded quickly. His thick lips parted in a smile, and one hand fell upon the king's shoulder. Never mind, Leopold. I should not have spoken harshly to you. It is difficult sometimes to behave with true propriety when the pressure of events is such as... You understand? But if the words were conciliatory, there was something in his eyes that had not softened. Leopold said uncertainly,
Yes, affairs of state are deuced difficult, you know.
He wondered, not without apprehension, whether he were not in for a dull siege of meaningless details on the year's trade with Smyrna and the long wrangling dispute over the sparsely settled worlds on the Red Corridor. Weenus was speaking again. My boy, I had thought to speak of this to you earlier, and perhaps I should have, but I know that your youthful spirits are impatient of the dried tale of statecraft. Leopold nodded.
Well, that's all right.
His uncle broke in firmly and continued. However, you will come of age in 2 months. Moreover, in the difficult times that are coming, you will have to take a full and active part. You will be king henceforward, Leopold. Again, Leopold nodded, but his expression was quite blank. There will be war, Leopold.
War? But there's been truce with Smyrna.
Not Smyrna, the Foundation itself.
But, Uncle, they've agreed to repair the ship. You said...
His voice choked off at the twist of his uncle's lip. Leopold. Some of the friendliness had gone. We are to talk man to man. There is to be war with the Foundation, whether the ship is repaired or not. All the sooner, in fact, since it is being repaired. The Foundation is the source of power and might. All the greatness of Anacreon, all its ships and its cities and its people and its commerce depend on the dribbles and leavings of power that the Foundation have given us grudgingly. I remember the time, I myself, when the cities of Anacreon were warmed by the burning of coal and oil. But never mind that. You would have no conception of it.
It seems, suggested the king timidly, that we ought to be grateful.
Grateful? Roared Weenus. Grateful that they begrudge us the merest dregs, while keeping space knows what for themselves, and keeping it with what purpose in mind? Why, only that they may some day rule the galaxy. His hand came down on his nephew's knee, and his eyes narrowed. Leopold, you are king of Anacreon. Your children and your children's children may be kings of the universe, if you have the power that the Foundation is keeping from us.
There's something in that.
Leopold's eyes gained a sparkle, and his back straightened.
After all, what right have they to keep it to themselves? Not fair, you know. Anacreon counts for something, too.
You see, you're beginning to understand. And now, my boy, one of Smyrna decides to attack the Foundation for its own part and thus gains all that power. How long do you suppose we could escape becoming a vassal power? How long would you hold your throne?
Leopold grew excited. Space, yes, you're absolutely right, you know. We must strike first. It's simply self-defense.
Weenus' smile broadened slightly. Furthermore, once, at the very beginning of the reign of your grandfather, Anacreon actually established a military base on the Foundation's planet, Terminus, a base vitally needed for national defense. We were forced to abandon that base as a result of the machinations of the leader of that Foundation, a sly cur, a scholar, with not a drop of noble blood in his veins. You understand, Leopold? Your grandfather was humiliated by this commoner. I remember him. He was scarcely older than myself when he came to Anacreon with his devil's smile and devil's brain,
and the power of the other three kingdoms behind him, combined in cowardly union against the greatness of Anacreon.
Leopold flushed, and the sparkle in his eyes blazed. By Selden, if I had been my grandfather, I would have fought even so.
No, Leopold, we decided to wait, to wipe out the insult at a fitter time. It had been your father's hope, before his untimely death, that he might be the one to... Well, well.
Venus turned away for a moment. Then, as if stifling emotion, he was my brother. And yet, if his son were...
Yes, uncle, I'll not fail him. I have decided. It seems only proper that Anacreon wipe out this nest of troublemakers, and that immediately.
No, not immediately. First, we must wait for the repairs of the battlecruiser to be completed. The mere fact that they are willing to undertake these repairs proves that they fear us. The fools attempt to placate us, but we are not to be turned from our path, are we?
And Leopold's fist slammed against his cupped palm.
Not while I am king in Anacreon.
Venus' lip twitched sardonically.
Besides which, we must wait for Salver Hardin to arrive.
Salver Hardin?
The king grew suddenly round-eyed, and the youthful contour of his beardless face lost the almost hard lines into which they had been compressed.
Yes, Leopold. The leader of the Foundation himself is coming to Anacreon on your birthday, probably to soothe us with buttered words, but it won't help him.
Salver Hardin.
It was the merest murmur.
Venus frowned. Are you afraid of the name? It is the same Salver Hardin who on his previous visit ground our noses into the dust. You're not forgetting that deadly insult to the royal house, and from a commoner, the dregs of the gutter.
No, I guess not. No, I won't. I won't. We'll pay him back. But I'm afraid, a little.
The regent rose.
Afraid? Of what? Of what, you young...
He choked off.
It would be a sort of blasphemous, you know, to attack the Foundation. I mean...
He paused.
Go on.
Leopold said confusedly.
I mean, if there were really a galactic spirit, it mightn't like it, don't you think?
No, I don't, was the hard answer.
Venus sat down again, and his lips twisted in a queer smile.
And so you really bother your head a great deal over the galactic spirit, do you? That's what comes of letting you run wild. You've been listening to Verisov quite a bit, I take it.
He's explained a great deal.
About the galactic spirit?
Yes.
Why, you unweaned cub, he believes in that mummery a good deal less than I do, and I don't believe in it at all. How many times have you been told that all this talk is nonsense?
Well, I know that, but Verisov says...
Damnation to Verisov. It's nonsense.
There was a short, rebellious silence, and then Leopold said,
Everyone believes it just the same. I mean, all this talk about the prophet Harry Selden and how he appointed the Foundation to carry on his commandments that there might some day be a return of the earthly paradise, and how anyone who disobeys his commandments will be destroyed for eternity. They believe it. I presided at festivals, and I'm sure they do.
Yes, they do, but we don't. And you may be thankful it's so, for according to this foolishness, you are king by divine right, and are semi-divine yourself. Very handy. It eliminates all possibilities of revolts, and ensures absolute obedience in everything. And that is why, Leopold, you must take an active part in ordering the war against the Foundation. I am only regent, and quite human. You are king, and more than half a god to them.
But I suppose I'm not, really,
said the king reflectively.
No, not really, came the ironic response. But you are to everyone but the people of the Foundation. Get that? To everyone but those of the Foundation. Once they are removed, there will be no one to deny you the godhead. Think of that.
And after that, we will ourselves be able to operate the power boxes of the temple, and the ships that fly without men, and the holy food that cures cancer and all the rest. Verisov said only those blessed with the galactic spirit could...
Yes, Verisov said. Verisov, next to Salver Hardin, is your greatest enemy. Stay with me, Leopold. Don't worry about them. Together we will recreate an empire, not just the kingdom of Anacreon, but one comprising every one of the billions of suns of the galaxy. Isn't that better than a wordy earthly paradise?
Yes.
Can Verisov promise more?
No.
Very well. His voice became peremptory. I suppose we may consider the matter settled.
He waited for no answer.
Get along. I'll be down later. And just one thing, Leopold.
The young king turned on the threshold.
Weenus was smiling with all but his eyes.
Be careful on these Nyack hunts, my boy. Since the unfortunate accident to your father, I have had the strangest presentiments concerning you at times. In the confusion, with needle guns thickening the air with darts, one can never tell. You will be careful, I hope. And you'll do as I say about the foundation, won't you?
Leopold's eyes widened and dropped away from those of his uncle.
Yes, certainly.
Good.
He stared after his departing nephew, expressionlessly, and returned to his desk. And Leopold's thoughts, as he left, were somber and not unfearful. Perhaps it would be best to defeat the Foundation and gain the power Weena spoke of. But afterward, when the war was over and he was secure in his throne, he became acutely conscious of the fact that Weenus and his two arrogant sons were at present next in line to the throne. But he was king, and kings could order people shot, even uncles and cousins.
4. Next to Cermak himself, Louis Bort was most active in rallying those dissident elements which had fused into the now vociferous Action Party. Yet he had not been one of the deputation that had called on Salver Hardin almost half a year previously. That this was so was not due to any lack of recognition of his efforts, quite the contrary. He was absent for the very good reason that he was on Anacreon's capital world at the time. He visited it as a private citizen. He saw no official, and he did nothing of importance. He merely watched the obscure corners of the busy planet and poked his stubby nose into dusty crannies. He arrived home toward the end of a short winter day that had started with clouds and was finishing with snow, and within an hour was seated at the octagonal table in Cermak's home. His first words were not calculated to improve the atmosphere of a gathering already considerably depressed by the deepening snow-filled twilight outside. "I'm afraid," he said, "that our position is what is usually termed in melodramatic phraseology a lost cause."
"You think so?" said Cermak gloomily.
"It's gone past thought, Cermak. There's no room for any other opinion."
"Armaments," began Docor Walto somewhat officiously, but Bork broke in at once.
"Forget that. It's an old story."
This book is continued on cassette number 4, side 1. His eyes traveled round the circle.
"I'm referring to the people. I admit that it was my idea originally that we attempt to foster a palace rebellion of some sort to install as king someone more favorable to the Foundation. It was a good idea. It still is. The only trifling flaw about it is that it is impossible. The great Salvor Hardin saw to that."
Cermak said sourly,
"If you'd give us the details, Bort."
"Details? There aren't any. It isn't as simple as that. It's the whole damn situation on Anacreon. It's this religion the Foundation has established. It works."
"Well?"
"You've got to see it work to appreciate it. All we see here is that we have a large school devoted to the training of priests, and that occasionally a special show is put on in some obscure corner of the city for the benefit of pilgrims, and that's all. The whole business hardly affects us as a general thing. But on Anacreon..."
Lamtarki smoothed his prim little Van Dyke with one finger and cleared his throat.
"What kind of religion is it? Hardin always said that it was just a fluffy flummery to get them to accept our science without question. You remember, Cermak, he told us that day..."
"Hardin's explanations," reminded Cermak, "don't often mean much at face value. But what kind of religion is it, Bort?"
Bort considered.
"Ethically, it's fine. It scarcely varies from the various philosophies of the old empire. High moral standards and all that. There's nothing to complain about from that viewpoint.
Religion is one of the great civilizing influences of history, and in that respect it's fulfilling..."
"We know that,"
interrupted Cermak impatiently.
"Get to the point."
"Here it is."
Bort was a trifle disconcerted, but didn't show it.
"The religion, which the Foundation has fostered and encouraged, mind you, is built on strictly authoritarian lines. The priesthood has sole control of the instruments of science we have given Anacreon, but they've learned to handle these tools only empirically. They believe in this religion entirely and in the spiritual value of the power they handle. For instance, 2 months ago, some fool tampered with a power plant in the Thessalakian temple, one of the large ones. He blew up 5 city blocks, of course. It was considered divine vengeance by everyone, including the priests."
"I remember. The papers had some garbled version of the story at the time. I don't see what you're driving at."
"Then listen," said Bort stiffly. "The priesthood forms a hierarchy, at the apex of which is the king, who is regarded as a sort of minor god. He's an absolute monarch by divine right, and the people believe it thoroughly, and the priests, too. You can't overthrow a king like that. Now, do you get the point?"
Hold on, said Walter at this point. What do you mean when you said Hardin's done all this? How does he come in?
Bort glanced at his questioner bitterly. The Foundation has fostered this delusion assiduously. We've put all our scientific backing behind the hoax.